The Nations, Part 2, Commentary for the May 3, 2025 Sabbath School Lesson by Stephen Terry, Director, Stillwaters Ministry, www.visitstillwaters.com. Whom shall he teach knowledge, and whom shall he make to understand doctrine? Them that are weaned from the milk and drawn from the breasts. For precept must be upon precept, precept upon precept, line upon line, line upon line, here a little and there a little. Isaiah 28, verses 9 and 10 in the King James Version. Even though it was the most used translation of the Bible when I was a child, I do not often refer to the King James Version due to its flaws. However, the basic principles of its translation of this passage are valid. Put more simply, if we examine something logically by proposing a major premise, a minor premise, and a conclusion, we can arrive at a true statement. A simple example. Insects have six legs. Ants have six legs. Therefore, ants are insects. The logic breaks down if any part of the syllogism fails. For instance, if the major premise was that insects sometimes have six legs, then the conclusion that ants are insects would change from a truth to an assumption. It may be true, but it also may be false. Adding the word sometimes to the major premise necessitates changing the are to may be in the conclusion. Getting to the truth in any matter is dependent upon properly constructed logic, even getting to the truth in Bible prophecy. We can find ourselves at a castle built of blocks that do not adequately support the structure. When that is discovered, it can be problematic to rebuild the structure properly. As with any building, it would require deconstruction and rebuilding with more stable materials. Among those dwelling in the structure we call church, there are those who are perfectly happy with the structure. Though flawed, it has seen them more or less safely through life, and they've taught the structure to their children, and their children have taught it to their children, flaws and all. Does one then go on building with the same blocks for the sake of continuity, even if all admit that the edifice is growing ever more prone to collapse over time? Or does one do what must be done and thoroughly examine the stability of the structure, shoring up in some places and rebuilding in others? This is not simply a process related to dogma. It speaks to the essence of church as an institution. It begs the question, is what we call church really church? It has been passed down to us over centuries, evolving along the way to become what we understand the institutional church to be today. Along the way, it has picked up unsavory attributes, simony, nepotism, and the institutional church in the role of mediator between humanity and God as the sole arbiter of who may or may not approach the throne of grace. Like so many closed societies, one must agree to an extensive list of demands to enter fellowship, even at the lowest levels. This is ironic, considering Christ's words in John 6:37, "Whoever comes to me, I will never drive away." Strange, then, that those churches have detailed information about how exactly to cast people out from the church. The same church that claims to be the body of the one who will never drive whoever comes to him away. But this is the logic of the truth as it exists in the modern institutional church. And my denomination, the Seventh-day Adventist Church, though calling itself God's special remnant, is not exempt from this. Our most out there vulnerability as a denomination is in the interpretation of Bible prophecy. When I joined the church at age 18, I was young and had not yet studied logic and how it works for getting at truth. Besides, the reasoning by the denomination was that since Christ is the truth in John 14, verse 6, and the church is the body of Christ in 1 Corinthians 12:27, the truth must reside only in the church. At my young age, this seemed irrefutable. But now I understand that the church is the body of Christ only as far as it manifests the character of Christ. A church full of selfish, greedy, manipulative devils is not the body of Christ, no matter what copyrighted denominational appellation is nailed on the front of the building. One might find a scintilla of truth there, but it would be despite the church rather than because of it. When a denomination sees itself as the sole arbiter of truth, it can manifest in several ways. It can manifest as isolation from others, not of their denomination. It can also manifest as extreme measures to assert control over the denominational narrative, despite ever-growing challenges to that narrative. It can manifest as my way or the highway interpretations of biblical prophecy, when legitimate and logical challenges to long-standing assumptions inevitably arise. For example, using the illustration of building a castle out of colored wooden blocks, should a person have the temerity to point out that a blue block could just as easily occupy the place of a green block, thereby changing the understanding of the building's structure, they would be rebuked because the idea differed from the founders and their most ardent supporters. The choice left for those who would challenge what is for what might be is to be pressured into either leaving the church or remaining within but silent, while never being allowed a position of influence within official denominational culture. One example of a denominational assumption related to a prophetic book is found in Daniel chapter 1, where Daniel and his three companions, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, want to eat only a vegetable diet. This is touted as support for the idea that a vegetarian diet is best, and Daniel was a lifelong vegetarian, just as we should be. This idea is unwarranted, for these boys, as observant Jews, would have participated in Passover and the temple sacrificial system, both of which were commanded to include the consumption of meat. It seems more likely that rather than try to explain the complex Jewish dietary laws to their overseer, it was much simpler to request a vegetable diet. Even today, Adventists, while traveling, may request a vegetarian meal, even when they are not vegetarian, to avoid trying to explain what unclean meats they are avoiding and why. We too often make assumptions about what the Bible is telling us based on what we want to believe, instead of questioning our beliefs in the matter. This is not surprising, as we see the same in the political arena as well. Looking for confirmation, even shaky confirmation, is a much more popular pastime than challenging ourselves over what we believe to be true. But any professional athlete can testify the failure to continually challenge ourselves can relegate us to the bench and out of serious competition for the prize. More examples are in Daniel chapter 2, an obvious error of interpretation that was around 50 years ago and still crops up today, was that the materials for the various parts of the statue were representative of the metallurgy of the empire in question. For instance, Greece under Alexander was said to have armor and weapons of brass, while the Roman Empire crushed all their foes with weapons and armor of iron. Why this ever became a popular understanding is beyond me, as both Greece and Rome were Iron Age civilizations at that time. The Iron Age had arrived at least 6 centuries before the reign of King Nebuchadnezzar of Babylon, the king Daniel identified as the head of the image in the king's dream. But the assumptions do not end there. The 10 toes are taught as 10 kingdoms that descended from the Roman Empire. Lists of those 10 kingdoms have been shared as biblical truth instead of the assumptions they are, despite Daniel referring to the feet as a kingdom and not kingdoms. I imagine this is an attempt to harmonize a later vision with 10 horns with this one. But the most egregious assumption regarding these feet and toes pertains to the stone cut out without hands that strikes the feet, bringing the entire statue to the ground. The Seventh-day Adventist denomination has long equated that stone with the parousia, even though the vast amount of time between the feet of the statue and the parousia is out of sync with the one after the other sequence of the other kingdoms of the statue. When we consider the chronology of the rest of the statue, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and Rome, it makes more sense that you see the stone as representative of the incarnation rather than the parousia. The incarnation, and not the parousia, occurred during the days of the Roman Empire, and Christianity grew from that point to become the largest religion in the world. While there are those who associate the Roman Catholic Church with a continuation of the Roman Empire, that the stone might be interpreted as a parousia, those efforts have only resulted in the vilifying of millions of Catholics through the centuries, causing more heat than light. After the Inquisition and various persecutions in the Old World, we should know better than to walk down the same path they once did. So much apocalyptic prophecy has been treated as though it was set in stone. That false certainty has bred an arrogance that causes us to function as though we are God's chosen and everyone else is headed to perdition if they do not wake up and smell the prophetic roses we have grown. However, those roses are getting crinkly and brown around the edges of the petals with age, and fewer are willing to receive that bouquet without question. It would not hurt to question ourselves as well, with a little humility, rather than a desire to squelch what cannot be controlled. Thank you for listening to this commentary podcast. You can find the written version of this commentary at our website, www.visitstillwaters.com. You can also find hundreds more commentaries, podcasts, articles, and links to books written by the author at that website. Once again, it's www.visitstillwaters.com. May God richly bless you and your family.